Hello, on this week's program, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns previews the Month of Moderns Festival, a series of concerts by the chamber choir, The Crossing. Susan Lewis explores the Woodmere Art Museum in Philadelphia's 69th annual juried exhibition, and we've two reports from the Kensington section of Philadelphia. Jason Pfeiffer previews this weekend's Kensington Kinetic Sculpture Derby, and Tom Keels takes us to Penn Treaty Park. The site celebrates a late 17th century agreement between William Penn and local Native Americans that made possible the founding of Pennsylvania. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WITI.
It could be a musical tsunami, an air raid siren, or even a religious experience. But in fact, it's The Path of Miracles, one of the new works being presented in the Month of Moderns Festival by The Crossing, a hand-picked 25-member professional choir formed in 2005 by choir director Donald Nally. The festival, which opens tonight at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill, will include 14 works over three concerts, all of them new to Philadelphia audiences, some of them world premieres. The Path of Miracles, written by British film music composer Joby Talbot, is the biggest of all of them, a full evening work and typical of the ambitious music that The Crossing was formed to sing, as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns now reports.
The old idea of choral music concerts usually involves some sort of traditional religious text and music that doesn't go terribly far in any one direction except in moments of hellfire and damnation. But Donald Nally, in his work with Choral Arts Society and at St. Mark's Church, always looked toward alternative expression, and never more so than now. His choir, The Crossing, goes to cutting edges that even the best-informed music lovers may not know exist. Such music doesn't sit easily in traditional circumstances. It requires a chorus that can work quickly and efficiently with every single singer pulling its weight and solving problems.
Let's start at the road, top of page 144.
I spend a significant amount of time every week, on the average of 45 minutes to an hour and a half every day, looking for new pieces. That's in conjunction with Marin, who's my assistant, well, my friend, but also who helps me out. So that, like, I'll be looking for stuff, I'll see that someone's done something. I have no idea who this composer is, but maybe the program note I'll find online will be interesting or something like that, and I'll shoot her an email and say, can you find out about this piece, or can you find the piece if it's something that we think that we might want to look for, you know, because all of it, a lot of it has to be found from the composer or from some publisher that we don't know where we're starting from.
By no means is The Crossing the only group doing this kind of music. Small, forward-looking choirs like this one have been popping up in all sorts of places from Seattle to Austin, Texas. While choral music used to be a stepping stone to higher-profile orchestral commissions, credible popular composers such as Eric Whitaker, Bo Holton, and Tarek O'Regan are making a name in the medium and staying with it. Other established composers are looking towards these new vocal possibilities. The 2008 Pulitzer Prize winner for music went to one such work, The Little Match Girl Passion by David Lang. Because The Crossing has no conventional support staff, it keeps overhead costs low, many members have extra musical tasks, such as the aforementioned Marin Montalbano. During a break in rehearsal, she explained that she gets the schedules out to the right people and finds places to stay in Philadelphia for the handful of singers that come in from out of town. Such dedication was born out of an appreciation that began not from singing with the group, but from hearing it.
When I was sitting in the audience and listening to that, all I could think of was God, I wish I could be in a group like that. And there was an opening in the alto section, and so I started singing, and I'm really, really glad I did.
Donald Nally, for one, has one of the great part-year jobs in the business. He's chorus master at Lyric Opera of Chicago, having gone there from the Welsh National Opera. What draws him back to Philadelphia? Well, not money. He makes none from the crossing. In fact, some of his personal finances go into running it. During his years at St. Mark's Church, he and his singers developed an appetite for modern music that they wanted to explore further. The first concert in 2005 was basically for their pleasure, but an audience showed up and continued to.
I think that's why the audience comes. There's some discovery of truth somewhere in something that these singers find within themselves when we work together, which, again, sounds very self-serving, but that's why I come back and, you know, live in somebody's living room for 6 weeks in Philadelphia so that I can, you know, work with this group.
Though much in the Crossings programs is traditionally beautiful, the Month of Moderns Festival has several newly commissioned works set to poems by Paul Celan, a Romanian Jewish writer who survived German labor camps in World War II but was so scarred that he eventually ended his own life. So everything is not so pretty, but is part of a zeitgeist that acknowledges not all is well, or not much is well, in the 21st century. Performing this kind of music at a high level involves a teamwork that goes well beyond a conductor waving his arms at a group of singers. Nally admits his way of working has come about only after he got the traditional choral masterpieces out of his system. He also has had periods when he considered leaving the profession. Prior to his Lyric Opera of Chicago position, he spent 15 months living in a remote part of Maine. The problem, he admits, was perhaps best articulated by a difficult letter written to him by one of his choristers, a letter that he has committed to memory and recalled during our car ride after rehearsals.
You don't use what you can. You could easily get these people to sing like gods. And you stand in front of them and you just get angry and frustrated. You have somehow fallen off the wagon and you think that people are supposed to just somehow know what you're hearing. Well, you know what? They don't, and they never will. It doesn't matter whether it's choral arts or the Philadelphia Orchestra or whatever. It's your responsibility. You chose the life. Now either do it or get out.
Good thing he didn't get out, because the Crossing is the kind of organization that makes a difference both in the larger artistic landscape and in people's worldview. Audiences go to the concerts, perhaps for the sheer quality of the singing, but they will likely come away with something that changes their ideas about what music can be.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Crossings Month of Moderns Festival begins this evening at 8 and continues on Friday, May 22nd and Friday, June 6th. All concerts take place at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Juried art shows, where artists compete to be included and those accepted may vie for prizes, have a long tradition in art communities, the 18th and 19th century Paris salons being among the most notable. A Philadelphia area museum, which celebrates the artists of the region, has held such an event every year since its founding in 1940. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to the 69th annual juried show of the Woodmere Art Museum.
Imagine an open gallery space where several hundred paintings, drawings, photographs, and even sculptures congregate. Each work has already gone through one selection process, chosen by its creator for submission to a juried show. It's a decision that can be fraught with feeling, constrained by practical considerations, or made quickly as the deadline nears.
It's a really emotional process. I think if it touches me strongly, it's going to touch someone else.
I can't ship certain things. Sometimes it's too difficult.
I usually wait to the very last minute and try to make a gut choice.
Objects of artwork everywhere waiting to be judged, accepted or rejected, used to be the selection scene at the annual juried show at the Woodmere Art Museum. Today, the selection of works is made on the basis of images submitted digitally. The jury, or in this case, the single juror, is selected by the museum, where Michael Schantz is director and CEO.
What you'd like to do is pick a juror who has sensibilities not only as a painter or a sculptor, but understand all media. It really is the idiosyncrasies of the particular juror that are reflected ultimately in the selection.
This show's juror is artist Sam Gilliam from Washington, D.C., whose 1995 Mixed Media on Paper appeared in the Woodmere's recent exhibition In Search of Missing Masters. He says the show depends on what comes in from the community, which he evaluates against what he knows both of the area and the larger world.
It's that what I see is what I get, literally. I find out what people are doing at that time. I find out what changes are being made compared to what artists are doing on the outside. And then I make that hard decision as to what is the most interesting in terms of tactics.
While Shantz notes that nothing is shockingly avant-garde, no pickled pigs or the like, a range of tactics are in evidence in this exhibition of around 100 works in a variety of media, from figure drawing to watercolors to mixed media and sculpture. Laura Pritchard's bright yellow portrait, homage to Ramirez, is batik on silk.
I paint with molten wax first, every place that's going to be white, and then dyes are painted over top of the wax, and the dye does not go into the silk where the wax is. And the process is repeated until the field is totally covered, and then the wax is taken out.
A colorful mixed media quilt called Urban Voodoo by Tony Kersey had its beginnings in a dream.
One piece led into another piece that led into another piece. I wanted it to have a lot of contrast. I knew that I wanted it to have a lot of syncopated rhythms. Colors move through a piece in a certain way. If you had to liken it to a piece of jazz, it would be the drums and the horns, and you could hear the guitar or the bass all happening at the same time and moving across the page.
A 5-foot-long sculpture made from pieces of cherry wood, brass rods, and stones sits on the floor, a recent incarnation of the kind of sculpture that Diane Pepe began after a trip to Japan.
The wood and the rods were sort of the structure of these people, and the stones reflected their energy and their spirit.
Each of these works has won a prize in its category, portrait, mixed media, and sculpture, respectively. But the whole system of admission and prizes can be mercurial.
2 years ago, I submitted and was accepted, and then last year I submitted and was not accepted, and then this year I was submitted and I was accepted and then won a prize.
Not just a prize. Painter Thomas Delport won top honors, the Woodmere Endowment Fund Memorial Prize, for his oil on linen, called Network of Conversations, a still life that seems anything but still. He says he focuses on color rather than objects because things reflect or absorb from their surroundings.
If you were to put a white vase in a blue room, the vase you know mentally is white, that would be the said color, but the observed color would be what's being reflected on it.
And the paint itself seems to dance on the page.
Because I have a large amount of paint on the brush and how I push it onto the canvas, it tends to pull away and cause texture. So it adds another kind of dimension to it. It's the thickness of paint as well as the color that I want you to see.
Wanting to engage viewers is part of what drives artists to submit to shows such as this one, risking rejection, but reinforcing a sense of community, both with other artists and the audience.
One of the things that I like to do is when I'm in a show someplace is kind of be a fly on the wall and stand near my piece and listen to what people have to say about it.
You know, people will come up and say, ooh, this reminds me or looks like music. They see things that I necessarily are there consciously, but maybe they're subconsciously, and then you start to look at them in a different way.
It's just another way of sharing.
Juried shows are not universally accepted, says Michael Shantz. Some older successful artists don't bother to submit. Conversely, some museums are more object-oriented as opposed to serving the artists themselves. While the Woodmere has acquired a significant permanent collection of American art, Shantz thinks of it as an artist's museum, with a history and a venue especially suited to carry on this tradition.
Artists were the founders. They were the first management of this institution. For us, the juried show is symbolic, really, of a relationship with the artists that go way back.
And so the relationship also moves forward with the Woodmere's 69th annual juried exhibition, more than 100 works, 20 prizes, and an invitation to audiences to discover the creations of some of the region's brightest artists.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Woodmere Art Museum's 69th annual juried exhibition opens tomorrow and runs until June 7th. In about 45 minutes or so at 12 noon, just a few miles northeast of Center City, Philadelphia, the third annual Kensington Kinetic Sculpture Derby will take place in conjunction with the Trenton Avenue Arts Festival. The novel event is designed to celebrate human-powered transit and showcase the creative energy of an evolving community, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports.
As the name implies, the Kensington Kinetic Sculpture Derby requires participants to create art on wheels. The wheels must be powered by humans, not machines. According to organizer Catherine Doherty Chapman, the Derby is not a race that measures velocity and might.
It's a design competition, so it's not just, oh, I'm going to ride my bike in this festival. I mean, you really have to have an interesting theme and an interesting costume and sculptural artistic elements to your vehicle.
To underscore the irrelevance of speed, there's an award given for second to last. And while past derbies have included impressive demonstrations of creativity, from a pirate ship to aliens to a pink army tank, the judging of these vehicles extends beyond aesthetic factors. The competition course includes obstacles, hills, sand, cobblestone streets, and even a mud pit. So some mechanical know-how is also necessary. Accordingly, there is an award for Best Engineering, along with awards for Best Art, People's Choice Award, and Best Breakdown. Quirky honors and course obstacles are part of a kinetic sculpture derby tradition that now extends across the country, in Baltimore, Oregon, Arizona, California. Catherine Doherty Chapman says a man named Hobart Brown started the first derby in 1969.
He was an artist in a small town in California and decided to make some artistic improvements to his son's tricycle, making it a pentacycle. His neighbor saw what he was doing, thought, I could do that better. And so he did, and they decided to race each other down Main Street, and it just sort of blew up from there.
Doherty Chapman, who works for the New Kensington Community Development Corporation, says Philadelphia's Derby began 3 years ago as a way to celebrate the vitality of the Kensington neighborhood. Historically a gritty, industrial part of the city, home to textile mills, warehouses, and breweries, today it's increasingly attracting young artists and craftspeople looking for affordable studio spaces and homes. This year's Derby has nearly 20 teams. One, the Sand Reckoner, is led by mechanical engineer John Spitrino. Spitrino, a veteran of all the Kensington Derbies, says the annual event provides him with a creative outlet.
I can't really find that in my 9-to-5 job. You know, it's an engineering job, but it's not really art, and I'm both an artist and an engineer, and yeah, they're both my passions, and this is kind of a unison between the art side and the engineering side, and that really drives me, so that's what I come back.
Spitrino returns this year with a team of 6 people. Using a friend's warehouse, they've been working on their Sand Reckoner vehicle since late February. Built with parts from 2 chopped-up bicycles, hundreds of feet of steel, rims from a 95 Mustang, and a steering wheel made with 10 bowling pins, the nearly 10-foot-high creation looks like a cross between an oversized tricycle and a yacht. What the unfinished piece will ultimately be is unclear. The team wasn't offering any hints. But it's big, requiring 3 people to operate it. So there was room for me to jump aboard for a test run at Front and Diamond Streets in Philadelphia earlier this week.
Okay, let's go.
As Spitrino, Dave Bailey, and Tom Carr navigate the streets with their 8-foot-wide-by-10-foot-long contraptions, pedestrians stop and pull out their camera phones. Drivers wave from cars. Residents of the neighborhood call out from their stoops.
Oh, my God! I like it!
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what you call that?
It's the Sand Reckoner.
Yes,
sir. Tom Carr, a member of the Sand Reckoner team, says these kinds of reactions are common when they bring out their vehicle.
People genuinely know that we built this with our hands, and that it really gives them a smile. And there's a certain sense of connectivity. Like, we become more connected to the community, and the community feels like it's more connected to us as part of the community.
While instilling community pride, John Spitrino says the Kensington Sculpture Derby also encourages sustainable living.
You know, it's like using what's around instead of, you know, taking something and throwing away and going to the store and buying a new one. You know, like, everything here is reconditioned, pretty much.
Festival organizer Catherine Doherty Chapman says that as many green businesses and environmentally minded people have established themselves in the Kensington area, the Derby is part of a larger initiative.
People here really want to try and make this neighborhood one of the most sustainable neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And so part of the underlying theme of the Kinetic Sculpture Derby is to celebrate sustainability. It's not just planting a tree or, you know, taking the bus to work. It shows like how creative you can be, and it's not that hard to be green.
The Kinetic Sculpture event partners with the four-year-old Trenton Avenue Arts Festival, which has grown from 50 vendors to 125 vendors, attracting thousands of visitors. Katie Van Villette, the artist coordinator of the festival, says the Derby helps bring people out and provides an art exhibition of sorts within the festival.
I mean, after they get back from their parade, the sculptures are on display, and they're definitely not in as good of shape as they were before they left. They're still a wonder to see.
A wonder that is growing in popularity in Philadelphia, celebrating art, sustainability, and community pride. While you would be hard-pressed to find these sculptures in a museum, the Kensington Kinetic Sculpture Derby is a reminder that visual art comes in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes it can even take you for a ride.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Kensington Kinetic Sculpture Derby and the Trenton Avenue Arts Festival take place this afternoon on Trenton Avenue in Kensington. And while the Arts Festival celebrates the new Kensington, just over a mile south at the Delaware River, sits a place where people have gathered since Philadelphia's earliest days. Penn Treaty Park may well be the least well-known, most historic site in the city. In 1682, William Penn concluded a land treaty with Native Americans there, establishing his tradition of peaceful coexistence for his new settlement. Now WRTI's Tom Keels takes us to Penn Treaty Park, which has survived for over 300 years, even as its surrounding community has undergone numerous changes.
On a recent Saturday, thousands of people converged on a 7-acre green space in a semi-derelict industrial area between I-95 and the Kensington waterfront. Overshadowed by an abandoned Pico power plant, Penn Treaty Park is hosting Shadfest, a celebration of the area's early days as a fishing center. But, according to historian Ken Milano, author of The History of Penn Treaty Park, this spot was an important meeting place centuries before the first Europeans arrived in America.
It was a major focal point for the local Native Americans, and they would meet here and have their council. It was also the terminus of a major transportation route. Today's Germantown Avenue, Old York Road, and Frankfort Avenue were all Indian trails. They all come together right around this point.
It was only natural that William Penn would pick this place, a village called Shackamaxon, with regular canoe ferry service, to draw up a pact with its Native American inhabitants on his first visit to the New World. In November 1682, Penn negotiated a treaty of amity and friendship with the Lenni Lenape tribe beneath an ancient elm tree. Ken Milano views this treaty as the first step in the founding of Pennsylvania.
The wampum belt that still exists, that's the one they gave to Penn, and they had one that they kept themselves. And on there you see Penn and Tammany holding hands, I think. So that's the written document. That's the Treaty of Amity and Friendship.
In the 18th century, the surrounding villages of Kensington and Fishtown grew into industrial powerhouses, home to fisheries, shipyards, and textile works. Despite this development, the Penn Treaty site remained untouched. Artists like Benjamin West and Edward Hicks created images of the treaty negotiations which became world famous. Today, many of these images have been gathered in a museum near the park by Kensington historian John Connors.
I thought there was a story that needed to be told that most people didn't know about it. It's an international story where now we have images from Italy, France, Germany. So that all over the world, people were enamored by the ideal of this fairness and friendship image that was started by Benjamin West.
After Benjamin West depicted Penn's treaty with the Indians in 1772, primitive artist Edward Hicks borrowed his central image and incorporated it into his numerous paintings of the peaceable kingdom, which show God's creatures living in harmony as predicted in the book of Isaiah. John Connors points out a caption to a Hicks painting which illuminates the significance of these iconic figures.
Penn's treaty with the Indians made without an oath and never broken, the foundation of religious and civil liberty in the United States of America. Voltaire is also quoted as mentioning this treaty, never written, never broken. So they always would use this image because it is fairness and friendship.
In 1893, the city of Philadelphia made the treaty site into a public park. Today, Penn Treaty Park represents another kind of freedom. It's one of only two places in central Philadelphia where you can actually stand on the banks of the Delaware. Of the 1,100-plus acres of Delaware riverfront stretching from Allegheny to Oregon Avenues, only 8 are undeveloped and accessible. Penn Treaty Park accounts for nearly all of those 8 acres. Urban planner Brenna Herpman believes that the park will play a critical role in future plans to green the Delaware waterfront.
When you look at all of the plans for development south of here, to Center City, I mean, it looks like there's going to be another Center City coming to this part of the waterfront. It's crazy. There are many, many high-rises. And so Penn Treaty Park is precious in that way. It's an open space, and it'll be maintained as an open space. And it'll only become more important as the development comes.
Herpman, who works with the architecture and design firm of Studio Brian Haynes, sees Penn Treaty Park as a keystone of the Central Delaware Riverfront planning process. This plan, developed by Penn Praxis and the City of Philadelphia, proposes to create a network of parks, greenways, and watershed areas along the Delaware Riverfront. As an initial step in the project, Studio Brian Haynes is working with the Friends of Penn Treaty Park and other community groups to develop a master plan to redesign the space. Town meetings are being held, where local residents can offer ideas on how to improve the park while retaining its simple nature.
People in the neighborhood feel like Penn Treaty Park has been a little bit neglected, and it needs an infusion of interest and money, and, you know, it sort of needs a facelift. People like the tranquility of this park. They don't necessarily want it to be a recreational center. They like the sort of bucolic feeling of it. So we're trying to maintain a lot of the character that's here, but, you know, sort of bring in some other elements as well.
Kevin Musselman is a spokesman for the New Kensington Community Development Corporation, which offers support services to local homeowners and businesses. He sees the rich heritage of the Penn Treaty Park as a key to the soul of the neighborhoods of Fishtown and Kensington.
The history in terms of Revolutionary War, American Indians, all of those different layers of history that exist really contributes to the cultural identity that exists here. It's something that longtime residents hold dear. Even if they weren't alive at the time, they can tell you why Fishtown is called Fishtown, how it got its name. The fishmongers that used to live here and go down to Front Market.
Meanwhile, with events like the Shad Fest, the residents of Kensington and Fishtown are striving to bring more Philadelphians to the spot where their city was actually born.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.